get up.
I mean, of all things to say.
What?
What? I want a victory beer.
He's a 7-time champion.
Right. Oh my God, that is hilarious.
Hey everybody, it's Dale Jr. back again in the Bojangles studio for another episode of the Dale Jr. Download with my co-host Mike Davis. Mike, it's Tuesday, April the 4th, and we got some dirty air and Ash Jr. on deck. How was your April Fool's? You get any good April Fool's jokes pulled on you, man?
I did not. In fact, I didn't even realize it was April Fool's Day till late in the day. Way later than you usually find out April Fool's. Did you? Did somebody prank you?
Nope. But April Fool's is also, April 1st is also my buddy Sean Brawley's birthday. Everybody might remember Sean from the old Nationwide commercials with him and Sonny. But we had an Easter Earnhardt family reunion on Sunday, which was wonderful. I was down at the saloon with all of the Earnhardts, and we watched a little bit of the race as best we could. The service down there was kind of iffy, but I was able to see pretty much most of the race. We had Easter egg hunt and hay rides, and we grilled a bunch of cheeseburgers and hot dogs.
Y'all had a full-on bunny.
Yeah.
I saw somebody in a bunny costume. Was that Sean?
Yeah, Sean. Amy ordered a bunny outfit. Sean put it on, came out, and had pictures with all the kids and everything. And Sean's son, Lawson, says, "That ain't no real bunny. He's got daddy hands."
Ain't going to fool him.
Nope. He's got daddy hands.
Daddy hands.
I thought that was hilarious.
That is
he
funny.
Ain't got bunny hands.
That's funny.
Anyways, we got a bunch of stuff here on the table. So,
yeah, what all you have here?
Well, first off, ever since we started talking about candy cigarettes and other crazy nostalgia, these things have been showing up everywhere.
So our loyal listeners have started sending in the candy cigs.
Yeah, these are the bubble gum ones. Not really my favorite. I don't like the bubble gum ones that much. But the chalk ones, you know, basically kind of like eating a piece of chalk that tastes like sugar. I think that's what I got right here. But, you know, because they do make two different types.
I didn't know. I thought they were just gum.
No,
but they're
they
not.
Do have the chalk. These are the, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. These are the chalky ones. Those are the best.
Slide this
That's
around.
What's up right there, man. Them things, man.
Is that what they do?
You want to eat one, Mike?
I might, yeah.
Go ahead, man. You think your dad's going to be okay with that? I mean, I know he.
All right, what do you got, a teeth joke? Is that what it is? Is that where we're going with this?
I mean, he's you're probably his best customer.
I got it. All right. Fun.
Clean them things
for
days.
We're having fun today.
Yeah.
All right, let's see here.
He has to have you come back two trips.
I missed a dentist appointment the other day. All right.
You what? You missed a dentist appointment? I bet he's home crying.
Yeah, this isn't what I remember.
Right? That's the ones I remember.
But it'll look like you're smoking? Or is it just literally just
a
prop?
Stick of chalk.
That's it.
Eat it. I told you that I liked them because they taste good, not because they really look like a cigarette.
Yeah.
You like it because it makes you look cool.
Yeah.
But
and I don't feel cool right now.
Right. I just eat them. What do you think?
I've had better candy.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. I know it's probably not top candy in the world.
I'm gonna do a.
Nobody said this was the number one best candy in the world.
I'm going to do a candy cig review. Let's see here.
Oh, God.
Yeah. You know what? Did you say it's like chalk?
It's sugary chalk.
Tastes like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Has a little sweet thing. A little bit like a sweet tart, but not nearly as good. Kind of like an aftermarket, not sweet tart, but sweet tart. What am I trying to think of?
Spree.
What?
Smarties.
Yeah, it's an aftermarket Smarties, what that tastes like.
One hell of a review. Good job, Mike.
Yeah. Here, send me over a piece of gum.
Okay.
Is it the gum?
All right, look, we're thankful for everybody sending these over here. I've been sharing them with the guys out in the shop. You'd think that we had a deal with these folks, but anyhow, thanks for everybody that sent us. those are ridiculous. My gosh. The gum ones
a little
just,
old. Yeah. The smoke's done gone, y'all.
All right. So, anyways, also on the table right here, man. This is really cool. I don't know if everybody else will think is as cool as I do, but I went to Gary Hargett's shop. Gary passed away recently. Gary Hargett used to help me actually own the car I drove in '93, '94 in the late model stock series, raced at Myrtle Beach in Florence and a few other tracks. And man, I'm, if we spent 2 years together, I swear it felt like 10. And he became like a grandfather to me. But I went by his shop to look at some photo albums and try to retrieve some pictures and stuff. And his family was there helping me kind of go through what was there. Shop full of nostalgia and racing history and old parts and all kinds of pictures and stuff. But anyways, I found a trophy. And this trophy right here that's on the table is the trophy that me and Gary won in 1994. My first late model stock win. And so it's from Myrtle Beach Speedway. I think it's the only race I won two races at the beach. But it's we won this race in 94. And I don't know why it was at Gary's shop. You know, I guess, you know, back then I didn't care about the trophy. I just thought it was cool we won and was ready to go to the next race. And Gary put the trophy on a shelf in the shop. And I thought I was going to race out of that shop forever, right? Mm. And so when me and Gary split up, I basically came in there one day and I said, hey man, dad said I could bring all my stuff up to the, you know, up to Mooresville. I'd like to, it'd be right there where I can work on it. I can learn on, you know, work on the car every day and learn how it works and put it back together and all that. And I wanted Gary to come with me, but Gary didn't want to do the hour drive to work every day. So the trophy stayed, had all the things I tried to gather to take up to Mooresville to, you know, as far as cars and parts and pieces and pit boxes and trailers and all that, the trophy state. But anyways, I was able to go and look at the shop, and man, it brought back a lot of memories. Got a bunch of photos that I'm so excited to be able to share once I get them all cleaned up and scanned. But this trophy right here, man, I never thought, I didn't know where it was. I didn't think I'd ever see it. I didn't even know what it looked like. I didn't even remember what it looked like, but here it is. Careful.
I'm going to be careful, but I want to read it.
Hey, he's now. That thing's brittle. Well, read it.
Myrtle Beach Speedway, 8/20/94, Winston Racing Series, feature division, first place.
There you go. Simple enough. and so, real thankful to have that. Glad to come here and share it with all y'all today. And
question. When we did that Myrtle Beach Lost Speedways episode, we showed a couple wins. Was one of those the first one? So this is the trophy for that race that we saw in Lost Speedways.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yeah. Now Mike's happy.
Mm-hmm. I was always happy.
He tied it back into his own life.
Really? Yeah. Is that what I did?
Yeah.
Lost Speedways?
The show you look, this is Lost Speedways.
Your idea. Okay.
You connected it to your own personal memories.
Well, I have to because, I mean, you remember hardly anything of it.
I remember stuff.
Okay, was that not a feature, a double feature, a double race that day?
Yeah.
Or did you win the first or second one?
First one.
Okay. How'd you do in the second one?
Probably third or fourth.
Was it third or fourth?
One of the two.
I'm playing with you. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. Okay, and so do trophies exist of you won four times?
I've won twice at the beach and once at Florence.
Got those trophies?
Not a clue.
Man. I do think it's cool. I bet that going into Gary Hargett's shop was like going into a museum or going back in time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had let this is a little decal that came. You can't really tell it. It's no point in showing it to the camera, but it's an old decal from his race shop. There's a sign on the front of the door that looks just like that. Anyways, man, let's get into some real cool.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on. The appeals committee has amended HMS's penalties, and there has been a lot of response to this one. A lot of people don't understand why they give them the points back and still charge them the money. One of the, you know, Jordan Bianchi went through the garage and sort of anonymously polled the opinion of mechanics and crew members and crew chiefs and so forth, GMs for different teams. Every one of them were like, you know, I don't understand this. It's opening up Pandora's box. How are you going to police this? You know, the teams going forward. I guess maybe you could help me understand it, but I don't know how you get your points back but still get charged, financially.
Yeah.
I don't know why the committee chose to do that. I know that HMS had a really, really, really good argument, and they had the receipts. They had the texts, the emails, that would basically exonerate them and help someone understand the confusion, right, of how that all came about. And so in that, with what I know, I don't know how they didn't get it all overturned, you know. And so, but yeah, they still fined them $100,000 per car, you know, which is a lot of money. I know people think, you know, it's a lot of money. We run this race team right here. We can't afford $400,000.
No,
we can't.
Nope.
That's our plus or minus for the season.
Right.
You know,
we're
going to maybe make a couple hundred grand. We're going to maybe lose a couple hundred grand. And you just don't know which it's going to be when the year starts. And so if you're racing that tight at the budget, I imagine at the cup level, there's less, you know, there's about the same amount of wiggle room. So, you know, whatever profit they might make in the season, that's going to eat right on into it, if not make it a loss for the year.
Can I just ask this question real quick? I mean, like, I think we need to, and I'm asking because I don't know, but I think we need to kind of go through exactly what this appeals committee is. Who decides who the appeals panel is?
That's a good question too. I mean, it seems like it's sort of a random draw out of the hat. They got a mix, you know, maybe a bag full of names that they, not metaphorically, not literally, but they got a list of names and they just sort of pick randomly. I don't really even know because the group of people I haven't heard about who's on every appeal, but when I have, it's been pretty random.
Mm-hmm.
And which I think is a good thing.
I think that's picked by a third party because I heard Elton Sawyer talking about his response to it, and you know, NASCAR's upset that they gave him back what they gave him.
Yeah.
Like they're not happy, so it's not NASCAR. If anybody wants to point fingers at NASCAR on why did NASCAR give him back points, that's not who you're supposed to be pointing fingers. They're unhappy that they got what they got back. So, and then they got some more appeals. I'm really waiting to reserve judgment until I see what happens with Colleague.
Yeah. I think that they have to give Colleague the same. I can't understand how you can't basically give Colleague the same treatment that you gave HMS. But the appeals panel will be different.
It'll be different.
They may interpret it differently.
And they're not going to have Hendrick arguing on their behalf. Hendrick just had a really good argument.
That's another thing. Colleague absolutely is communicating, has to be communicating with HMS going, hey, man, what do you think helped you in this scenario that we can use in our own appeal? And, you know, I don't know if Colleague has the receipts, has the text messages, has the emails that would show the appeal panel, hey, man, you know, there was communication here that gave us the idea that we were able to do these type of things. At one, you know, that's the way I read this is that at some point, HMS felt like NASCAR opened up the door for them to make these adjustments to the parts, to make the parts fit and make the parts get closer to the actual CAD design. And then NASCAR changed their communication, changed the wordage in their emails and said, nope, we don't want you doing this. But the cars were already on the West Coast swing and out there with the parts. And so, again, I think I myself, knowing what I know about it, felt like that you could definitely see HMS's point of view. The penalty was far too severe. It was a miscommunication. I don't think there was real intent there to cheat and make their cars faster and slide something under the table. I think when you look at all the things that they, you know, the communication between NASCAR and the teams and the organizations and Chevrolet themselves, the manufacturer, you could see where this type of thing could happen. The parts didn't race. All those things factor into my opinion being that the penalty was way too severe. But, you know, we'll see how they treat Colleague on this. Colleague only had one louver wrong. The other one wasn't wrong. Yeah, like why would you? It's not a blatant act of cheating because that appears to me to be more of a mistake than anything, right?
It looks like an accident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, not that accidents don't, you know, I don't think anybody cares whether you break a rule and it's an accident or not. I'm not saying that, but I do think that it's suspicious or it's weird that, you know, their intent certainly wasn't there. So, Colleague's appeal is tomorrow, Wednesday.
Yeah.
And then Denny's got his appeal Thursday, right?
Yeah, Denny's appeal is about words he mentioned on his podcast about intentionally wrecking Chastain at Phoenix. Denny has went on record in his own podcast saying, I got what I feel like is a very, very good approach to this appeal and argument for trying to overturn his own suspension. I think that's going to be more theater than the colleague racing appeal. I think everybody is expecting colleague to come out of there pretty much in the same scenario or the same situation that HMS is in. If they don't, everybody's going to wonder why in the hell not. But I think when they go paying attention to Denny's appeal on Thursday, I don't expect Denny's appeal to change. I really don't expect his punishment to change. If it does change, I can't wait to hear how he feels he made that happen. We get to, you know, he's going to, I'm sure, share with us on his podcast how the process went for him, win or lose. And that's going to be great for us to hear. That'll shed more light on that appeals process for everyone out there that wants to know how this all goes down. But anyways, we don't know anything till Wednesday, till Thursday, and we'll certainly react ourselves, but
I got a quick question
for you. Pretty fascinating.
I want to go. Denny brought up something on the podcast this week, and it made me want to ask you about it.
Yeah.
Denny asked, why can we not get back to the days where we could be completely transparent and NASCAR would be completely transparent, where I gather that they used to take an illegal part or something they perceived to be illegal and put it out for the entire garage to see. Is that correct? Yeah. And so
that was like not every week.
It wasn't?
No.
What I'm wondering. I'm like, was that an actual policy, or was that something that one competition guy at NASCAR, like a Darby, a John Darby, goes, like, I'm going to show them. Everybody's going to get to see this.
So basically we would go to Daytona and people would show up at Daytona with all kinds of weird cheated up stuff on their cars, and NASCAR would confiscate the piece or the part, and it would be in the hauler and not on display, not out on a table for everybody to walk around and look at. But if you wanted to see it, you could walk up in the hauler and it'd be laying there, you know, on the counter next to the cheese spread, you know. And so you could go up in there and say, I heard you took such and such. Where is it? I'd like to see it. They might show it to you. It might be laying there. They might not show it to you. There had been times, you know, one-offs where there was a table with parts on it, but for the most part, it wasn't, you know, too much. It wasn't NASCAR grandstanding and saying, ha ha, look, we got you. Here's all your stuff. Everybody come look at what they did, you know, did to their car. So
I think it's not a bad idea,
though. I don't love it.
I don't know.
I think it's silly. I think, look, if somebody, the louvers, right? Say they take the louvers and it starts circulating in the garage. Hey, guess what? Did you hear what happened to HMS? Man, I saw this. I saw that. I wonder what the part looks like. If people want to see the part, have them come up in the hauler, and the part can be up in the hauler, up in the trailer in the NASCAR hauler. If NASCAR confiscated it, they can set it up there. And if you want to see it, come on by.
Well, that's what we're talking about, right? You don't love that?
I don't love it out on a table for display.
Oh, okay. Well, but no, I'm saying, talking about the way they used to do it. If you're saying they put it out there, you could go see it. Wouldn't that at least give the teams a little bit more confidence? If there's all this ambiguity and concern by the teams, like Hendrick Motorsports going, hey, wait a second, y'all did this. And NASCAR's like, nope, you broke the rule. Put it out there show the teams what exactly they did wrong.
You're going to have to hire somebody to stand there the entire day to explain and showcase this part to every GM, every crew chief in the garage that wants to come by there and look at it. In between tech, in between cars qualifying, and all the other track activity. I mean, you know, it's doable, but you know, it's gonna slow down the day. It's doable. I don't know. I mean, I think I don't know what that really solves other than showing the teams, hey man, you know, yeah. I think it's fine if I'm trying to think, like, if I'm gonna put myself in I'm going to put my owner's hat on, and I'm going to the racetrack as an Xfinity Series owner. Somebody got caught with something. NASCAR took it. I don't need to see it. I trust that the part's illegal. I'm not going to be able to look at it and go do it to my car. And so I don't have this urge to take a look at it that I believe, you know, I don't, I'm not as curious about what they did to those louvers as the general public is or the race fan is. I think the race fan's, you know, curious to, and they have the right to be curious about it because we, you know, they don't have any idea of, you know, well, they want to make their own assumption of, oh man, yeah, that's definitely a rule, a broken rule.
You wouldn't be curious so that your team doesn't break the same rule?
Or they already know.
You wouldn't want to see a louver that if another team got popped for $400,000 and they're saying that you that they this wasn't illegal.
I can go
you don't want
to
know?
I could go talk to Elton Sawyer and he'll tell me the part, you know, he'll tell me, look, man, the area that they mess with was this area. Don't mess with that area. I don't need to look at it.
Okay. That's interesting.
I mean, there's a lot of energy you're wasting there, you know.
There just seems to be a trust problem, and there's a disagreement on what's illegal and what's not, and we're asking questions about, well, if you gave back penalties that you kept the fine, were they guilty or were they not guilty? Can you be half pregnant? What's the problem here? If they got their points back, if it wasn't illegal, why are you even keeping the fine on them?
All right, so I get that. I believe that it would be helpful to have a little transparency on the appeal, right? And what did HMS say that changed their minds? What was this information or what did HMS have on NASCAR that helped them win that points back? That's what I think everybody wants to know. And nobody's really coming out and saying it exactly what it was. But it's communication, that's text, email, whatever, right, that NASCAR sent to HMS that gave HMS the idea that this was okay, that this was something they could do. And then that communication changed within days, but their cars were already out doing what, you know, out on the West Coast swing, and there's, you know, there's what, two sets of louvers per car. You know, I don't know enough details to say more than that, but that's what we will want. That's what we all want to hear from either NASCAR, but you know, you're going to hear NASCAR's version of it. You're going to hear HMS's version of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of truth and falsehoods in each one, right? Their versions are their truths, right? They're not going to be the same. But it's just a lot of wasted energy on trying to, you know, figure out whether we should be looking at parts and all that. I mean, I just feel like that if they were, I'd just like to know why the appeals panel came to the decision that it came to. Specifically, like, all right, why did the money stay? Why did the points go back? What did HMS bring to the table that was so convincing, right? Convince us. Let us in on it. Because that's what is unfortunate is going forward, there's this, the reaction to the way the appeals committee amended the penalties, the reaction to that is almost as bad as or worse than the actual initial reaction to them getting caught, right, or the louvers being discovered. So I would like to avoid the misinformation or miscommunication about, you know, what happened in the appeal. What the hell happened in there that made them change their minds, right? How in the hell, you know, is an appeal won? Tell us, right? Details. And I think that's why I'm saying that I think Denny's appeal will be the most theater because he will tell us.
Yeah, right.
For once, we're going to get to hear probably more about the process than we've ever heard before.
He's already wanted to tell us before his appeal what he's going to argue.
Yeah.
Just like, Denny, I don't know if this is going to help you very much. Like, yeah. Just tell us after.
Yeah. Think about that, folks. So, you know, HMS did the same thing. You know, they went in front of the media, but they were very cryptic about the information they were willing to share to the media before the appeal because you don't want to tell your opponent how you're going to go in there and win, right? You're not going to tell them your playbook. And so, but even after the fact, after the Hendrick appeal has been changed and altered, we're still wanting more information about what was the game plan going in for HMS to change this appeal. And what information did they feel like was strong for them? I think with Denny's, we'll hear all this.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm looking forward to.
Let's
Let's move on to Richmond. Josh Berry finished second in the race. I'll lead off with that, man. Kind of a, you know, riding around the backside of the top 20 most of the day. Looking at lap times, you know, different parts of the race, they were about the same for everybody from second to 20th. Got that track position at the end and was able to capitalize on that. Great, great strategy by Alan Gustafson and his whole team, man. They, you know, they're working with all, you know, HMS has all four crew chiefs at home running those deals from the war room back in Charlotte. And so that's a little bit of a, you know, that's not preferable, but it still is doable. And so I was pretty happy for Josh to be able to, at least, you know, while he's having the opportunity to drive for Chase and help Chase out in that team, I was hoping that he would have a result, right, that he could come out of there and go, that right there is what I can do. And I know that, you know, he didn't run up front all day. I know that otherwise, without the strategy, it would have been a very, you know, probably frustrating, disappointing result. But, you know, they had a plan, and that sort of that strategic approach wasn't going to benefit them the track position till later in the race when it did. And just really good job by the whole team that was able to see, you know, something they could do different than the rest of the field. You know, it was a pretty good race. You know, looking at Jeff Gluck's poll on Twitter, Richmond usually fares pretty bad. We've all complained about the racing there. We complained about it leading up to the race weekend about, you know, man, what kind of race are we going to see? What should they do to this track? How could they make this a better racing track, you know, as far as action? But everybody seemed to enjoy it. Everybody seemed happy with what they saw.
It was good.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. The racing was competitive.
Yeah, the racing was competitive. The restarts were for the most part, really clean, but a lot of great hard racing. And couldn't really, you know, and it got shook up at the end. Truex looked like he had the best car. Yeah. And he ends up running out of tires. And so there was an exchange on the radio between him and his crew chief after the race.
Tense.
Yeah. And so, you know, the crew didn't tell Truex that he was on scuffs. And that's sort of the question, I think, in the public eye is, why didn't you tell your driver what the situation was? That is really frustrating as a driver to not get that type of important information. And I think James, his crew chief, was like, you know, I don't know that I help him by telling him that information. I could see both sides of it. When I was racing, I would tell my crew chiefs, you know, there's some things I just don't need to know.
That's right.
You know, and I don't tell me something that's going to put me on the defense. Don't tell me something that's going to make me doubt or lose faith or lose confidence in the car, in its abilities. And so I'll be honest, you know, I think, you know, Truex would probably love to have known he was on scuffs. But I wonder, the question I guess is, if he knows he's on scuffs, does he run worse? Does he finish worse? Does he, you know, does he go, you know, when he they take off on that first restart and he slipped real big in turn one and two and lost a lot of time to the front two cars and was kind of holding up the guys behind him. And I wonder, if he knows he's on scuffs, does he do a little more defense? Does he drive defensively? Does he maybe not restart where in the line he chose? Does he change all of those things, right, in an attempt to put the best defense on, right, to maintain the best position he can? Or does he hear, hey, I'm on scuffs, and does he lose his and say, why in the hell? How did this happen? We're screwed.
You would have.
Oh, yeah. I'd have finished 20th.
You would have. It would have been hell. Yeah. It would have been hell, and you would have let everybody know it.
Yeah. So I wonder, you know, if maybe not telling him, as hard as that is for people to understand, as hard as it is for Truex to stomach, you know, gosh, you know, why would you not tell me? I need to, you know, we all should be telling each other this information. We're a team. It's a marriage, right? It's a marriage, you liar. So I wonder if, you know, he actually might have ended up with the better result not knowing. You know, because
I think so.
Yeah.
Depends. I think so.
It really matters. It really matters what type of person you are, right? Not everybody reacts the same way to that information, right? And some people will go, all right, I'm on scuffs. I'm going to buckle down. I'm busting my ass, and we're going to freaking get out of here with a top five. You watch.
Right.
Some people are going to go, we're screwed.
Right.
See you at the hauler, you know, when I finish 15th.
There's the people that want to be challenged. I'm like, oh, okay, so yeah. I got scuffs. Like, this is your new reality.
There's very few of those. You're
right. Because most drivers are head cases, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that anybody in those situations, of those high pressure situations, are going to be mental.
Speak the truth. Yeah, that's it.
And yeah, I mean, like, I compare every scenario that I see on Sundays through what would you have done. And in that one, Dale, I remember, man. I remember when you wanted your tires, by God.
I won't be on the offense.
Yeah, you want your tires. You want to have everything going in your favor to be aggressive.
Yeah.
And if you did not get that, I remember that time Lance McGrew left you out on a caution so you could lead a lap, and you unraveled. Well, everybody else pit. So now you're the leader, but you're leader on old tires. Is it Charlotte?
I don't remember.
Oh, by God, I do. Everybody, that was a ripping for the ages.
Christopher Bell and William Byron got together. William had a great car. He might at times been better than Truex, but and had a real shot to win the race. But Christopher Bell and Byron get together on one of the last few restarts, and Christopher Bell blamed Chastain. Chastain just can't escape a race without somebody.
Even if you don't touch the guy, you get blamed. You get caught a wrecking ball.
Did you see Bob Pockrass on social media asked Kyle Busch, hey, Kyle, what do you think about that last restart or something like that? And Kyle goes around, talks about it for a little while, and then he finally goes, you know what? Some of those guys might need glasses. You know, I'm wearing glasses this year. It's really helpful. Maybe they need to go get looked at and go to the, I don't know if they need glasses or not, but maybe they need, you know. And I thought, that's a fair point. You know, you got, I just started wearing glasses. Harvick's wearing them. Logano's wearing glasses, you know, and they're doing really well. And so Kyle goes, hey, man, I'm going to wear some damn glasses. Let me go to the doctor. Oh, yeah, this is nice. I can see much better. And so I think Kyle's making a fair point. Maybe a little tiny sense of sarcasm in there, but for the most part, he's speaking the truth. Bob goes right to Chastain and says, Kyle Busch says you need glasses. It's a bullshit.
I love it. I wouldn't want Bob to frame that up any other way.
Oh, my
That goodness. Is hilarious. That's hilarious.
But the look on Chastain's face every time he gets one of these questions every week.
Yeah, well, the look on his face, I really did study that, because when they said, you know, Christopher Bell called you a wrecking ball, and he was like, almost like, really, what gives at this point?
Right.
Like, I'm really going to catch this? He goes, I didn't touch him.
Yeah.
He goes, I certainly didn't touch, who did they wreck? Byron?
Byron.
Yeah. I didn't touch him.
No.
I didn't even touch Christopher.
Yeah.
He wrecked him.
Yeah.
Christopher Bell wrecks Byron, and then Chastain gets called the wrecking ball.
Yeah. And I think Chastain's got a new narrative that I really like. He's like, and I hope he keeps this going. He's like, you know, it's funny these guys saying all these things, but when I see them, they don't say it to my face.
Mm,
I love that.
That's true.
I want him to keep that one going.
Yeah, yeah.
Denny, speaking of Denny trying to win his appeal, I don't think he did himself any favors this weekend.
Reckon Yaley.
He spun Yaley out. What you guys laughing at back here?
He admitted it.
Have you guys seen on Twitter the trend where people are, like, blaming Ross Chastain for everything?
Yes.
Here's a picture of Ross, like, in the Kennedy assassination.
Good Lord.
Or, like, he was the one who started the fight in the 1979 Daytona 500, or wrecked Carl.
Awesome. Yeah.
Wrecked Carl at Talladega. Yeah. I don't know. That's
hilarious.
Yeah, it was funny.
I hope that keeps on.
Yeah.
So Denny appears to get a little frustrated with JJ. That JJ and Denny's in the middle of a three wide, and JJ's smashing him into the car. I mean, there was a lot of contact, and literally the next corner, Denny drives through him. And JJ ends up in the fence, and Denny says that it was an accident, and he takes blame. And JJ gets out of the car and goes, "Yeah, the guy talking about respect is out here running over everybody. Isn't that ironic?" What's your thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, Denny took full responsibility for it. I mean, if Denny would have said,
"Do you think he did it on purpose?"
I'm going to take Denny at his word and say that he didn't. He said that I wouldn't wreck anybody for 30th.
Yeah.
No, That's my response. I don't think he did on purpose. I think he made it. Listen, Denny had a comedy of errors, to be honest with you. That Richmond did not go well for him. The two pit road speeding penalties. Like I think he was so frustrated at himself, and that it just ended up being a bad day gone worse. And no, I don't think he's wrecking people for 30th place. Do you think you disagree? I can tell. You think he wrecked JJ Yaley for 30th?
I think that he was frustrated, and I don't think that he wanted J.J. Yaley to be in the fence when it was all said and done, but I do think that he wanted to show his frustration to J.J. about how he felt like J.J. raced him literally just 500 yards before that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Denny's the kind of guy that puts people in the fence backwards on purpose. You know, I don't think that there's many guys that are like that. But if any at all, but I think he was frustrated. I think that he might have lost a little bit of control of his extremities there for a second.
His extremities.
Yeah. And it ended up being like I think I saw him do things that, you know, I've done something before on the racetrack where you're like, you son of a gun, bam, oh, shit. I didn't mean to do that, right? I didn't mean to, dude, I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, I just, damn, I f***ed up there, man.
Yeah.
My bad.
Okay. Well, I mean, listen, you may be right. Yeah. I guess, you know, listen, this is the thing about it, is that if we can appreciate drivers being honest with us, maybe even on a podcast, and then they get punished for it, now we're back to never knowing the truth, right? I mean, we'll never know the truth because it doesn't reward anybody for telling the truth. You get punished for telling the truth. So, I mean, I guess we'll never know really what happened.
The Harvick said drivers are becoming more aggressive because there's no consequences with the next-gen car.
I thought that was a good line.
Yeah.
I really like that. I mean, listen, it goes back to parenting, doesn't it? You got to have consequences to your actions. If you don't feel the consequences, you're going to continue doing the actions.
I understand. I wonder what he really means by that because, number one, we had guys getting hurt last year, and then, you know, because the car was too rigid, they've raced a little bit this year. We're not hearing quite as much about that, but right out of the gate at the Coliseum, guys were talking about how, you know, well, I'm not sure they've cured the rigidness of the cars, the bumper, the contact, and all that. So I say that not that, you know, to continue the narrative that there's a problem with this race car, but I say that that there are consequences, right? The drivers understand the consequences of injury or the potential for injury with this particular car. And it hasn't had a good reputation going back, you know, 24 months ago. So I, as a driver, I would have to imagine they're all out there going, I don't want to bop my head around. I don't want to put someone else in a situation where they could get, you know, banged up a little bit. There's got to be some of that concern out there. Is he talking about the consequences of the next-gen car in terms of how tough it is? Possibly.
I thought that's how I took it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's how I took it.
Yeah. Like the body doesn't, you know, there's not as much of a detriment to, you know, banging the body into things because it pops back into form. You're not absolutely going to lose performance aerodynamically like you would with the old steel body. I think that might be what he's talking about. I still don't love or feel confident in the idea of banging wheels with other guys because it does still seem to be fragile in terms of these toe links and keeping the, you know, keeping the toe and the geometry all going in the right direction. Of course, you know, Kyle Larson runs in the side of somebody on pit road, and I thought, man, he's done. That's bent some shit. He ain't going to have the front suspension is going to be a little askew. He said it drove horribly after that, but good enough to still win the race. I find that comment interesting, but I know Harvick knows his shit, so whatever he's trying to convey, he's probably right. Hamlin says our sport frowns upon hand-to-hand combat. They frown upon retaliation on the racetrack. So what's really the worst that can happen? What do you think he means by that?
They frown on hand-to-hand combat
They frown upon hand-to-hand combat. They don't like us punching each other. They frown upon on-track retaliation. So what's the worst that can happen?
What's the worst that can happen?
It's on your sheet. Tell me what you think.
I think it goes back to the respect thing of, like, why wouldn't guys just bump each other out of the way? What's the worst that can happen? What are they going to do? Because they've already made a precedent.
So you're saying, like, you know, NASCAR has created the narrative that you're not going to get out of your car and hit each other, and you're not going to retaliate. So now all these guys are shoving each other out of the way because they know there's no repercussions coming, right? Because NASCAR has buckled down and doesn't allow the drivers to go out there eye for an eye kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you take that, which is a great point,
too. I gotcha.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So NASCAR has, the drivers feel like they're not allowed to retaliate against each other, and if that's the norm out on the racetrack, then you're gonna have guys booting each other out of the way because they know, for the most part, that the culture is there's not gonna be anything coming back.
There's nowhere they can go that they can actually settle it. Was Austin Hill penalized for what he did to Myatt Snider last year?
Ooh, that's a good question. Andrew, do you remember?
I don't remember a penalty on that, and in that case, that would be NASCAR allowing hand-to-hand combat, wouldn't it?
I guess.
I mean,
that was real extreme. He laid
that's what I'm saying. If he didn't get punished for that, which I'm glad he wouldn't if he didn't. I just don't remember. But like I'm saying is that, where do you let these guys settle it and gain their respect? You got to have some issues ironed out. Where are you going to iron them out if not? I don't know.
I called Truex yesterday and I said, hey, man, going back to his comments with his crew chief, I said, hey, man, what's going on? You and your crew chief okay? And he goes, what you talking about? And I said, your post-race comments are everywhere. Everybody's listening to this little spat. And he goes, oh, just heat of the moment, man.
Right.
He's like, it's no big deal. And that's true. I mean, I people should go back and listen, go on to YouTube and watch some of the compilations that have been put together about drivers like myself, Kurt Busch, and others over the years in the past two decades. Because what I heard from Truex was tense, but nothing out of the ordinary.
Oh, you've said way worse.
Yeah.
To your crew chief.
Yeah.
During the race.
Yeah. But anyways, I got it from the man himself that
good.
He's like, we're already over it.
From what I see, no penalty from on that Austin Hill thing.
So there you go. So Denny wouldn't be correct if that's in fact what he said. He would say that if they frown on hand-to-hand combat, they didn't there. Don't you think that NASCAR actually – listen, I think we might be a little too hard on NASCAR in this thing. Listen, they got to be able to police the sport the way they want to police it, right? And this is a very volatile situation where drivers are going to have road rage for 300 miles, and they're going to do that. And then afterwards, we got to expect them to be able to vent it out, to be irrational at times, and not have severe consequences over it, right? Now – they've got, but then it's a judgment call on when they cross a line. So I don't know. I mean, like, I know why Denny feels that way right now. Frankly, I do. But at the end of the day, I think drivers are well within the right to go settle this themselves, as long as they're not putting anybody else in danger. Pit road officials, guys like that. You can't do that. You got to, because we didn't even talk about Suarez's penalty. Everybody agrees that one's justified, right? Yeah.
I will say this, man. I think that I think NASCAR does a really damn good job. I don't envy their position. I've said that.
Right.
I've said that before. But we're, I was faced with. I had to ask myself, after this past weekend, after the COTA late race restarts and all the comments and opinions about all that, and we sit down in here every week, just like a lot of people, and we go over what we don't like, what we liked, what we think should change. And a lot of times, we're adamant about some of those things. Man, got to change this. Why is it like that? Why does it got to be this way? And, I wonder sometimes whether we're a bit too neurotic.
Of course.
About it, right? Because I got worked up over the green-white checkers.
Yeah.
And then after the fact, I'm like, man, wonder if that's not as big a deal as I think, right? Does it really freaking matter that there's unlimited green-white checkers? I mean, I don't love it. It's not exactly how I do it. But it's the way NASCAR's doing it. And I've always, they always there always has been this great idea that this is their sandbox. You want to be here, you're going to play by their rules. I love that. I've always wanted it to be that way. And the sport's always kind of been better when there was a bit of a dictatorship style of rule and less collaboration and committee rule, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me, for sure.
I kind of always liked it when it was like one person at the top going, everybody come in the room, this is what's going to happen, everybody good, okay, see you, go out there and do it by the parameters that I've set. And I don't want to hear shit about it.
Right.
Right. And so, but, you know, it's fun to come in here and bullshit. And
that's right. I said last week, I wasn't exactly on the same page with you in terms of, but I've respected your opinion about the green white checkers. But frankly, I don't think NASCAR had anything to apologize for. Not NASCAR, not NASCAR fans after COTA, not anything. NASCAR is who we are. We talked about that a little bit. I also don't think that we have to apologize being neurotic. Yeah. Because this is what this I don't listen.
Hey, I hear you.
I've literally said this to some friends of mine at NASCAR. You know that they don't like the narrative a lot of times when people are being critical, and I'm like, listen, this is what you signed up for, man. I mean, like, you're the governing body. Listen, this is part of it. Don't you think that the commissioner of baseball and Roger Goodell in football? Listen. There's things that come with being at the top and being the governing body, and that is that you're the first person to catch hell when we don't like something, we don't get our way. But you know what? Don't make it change you. You're not going to change. We don't expect you to change. We expect you to deal with it and let us have our opinions and you stand firm. We respect what you have to do. We wouldn't want your job.
Yeah.
But this is what comes with the territory. Nobody needs to apologize.
Well, it's finally time for our favorite part of the show. What?
What just happened?
That was a great transition. Just like,
that's why we're here.
Straight off of Mike's rant. I love it.
That wasn't a rant. Was it a rant? Well,
you're passionate about it.
He's passionate.
Right. Yeah.
He's neurotic.
Well, let's get to our favorite part of the show.
All right, Ask Junior's on deck. Andrew's going to get our questions together. But Ask Junior's brought to you by Xfinity 10G Network. Let's take a look at the questions everybody's sent in to at Xfinity Racing on Twitter.
You ready to go?
Yeah, let's do it. Ask Junior on deck.
Let's fire it up. This first one comes from Connor. He said, something I see NFL players and coaches talk about a lot, it's their welcome to the NFL moment. It's either a coach chewing them out or that first moment where it becomes real. Did you have a specific welcome to NASCAR moment?
There was probably a couple. I went to Mike's got one.
Martinsville.
Oh, when I ran into everything, I'd ran a handful of races before that, but the welcome to is the welcome to moment. It's usually early. Right at the very front end. Yeah. I mean, I went to went to Japan and raced in that exhibition race, and Dad punting me on the last few laps. That was kind of my welcome to the big boys moment. I had new tires. I was trying to drive through the pack and get as good a finish as I could. We had like a 10-lap run to the finish. I caught Dad. We were coming up off turn 4. I needed to clear him so I could open up, I couldn't go full throttle off the corner because he's on my outside. So I'm sitting there running like 3/4 throttle, sliding up. And if I could clear him, I could get in the gas, right, and go down the next straightaway. And he's holding us up. And if I don't clear him, he's going to side draft me, and we're going to lose car lengths to the guys in front of us. And I need to go. Laps running down. So I just cut across his nose, and he had to lift to not get fenced. He was going to run into the wall if he didn't lift. But he kind of clipped me and then jacked me up down a straightaway and turned me sideways. He let go of me, and then I was able to go on and get a couple more spots. But he threw a shoe at me afterwards because he was mad at me. But so that was kind of my welcome to the big leagues moment. There was a couple more. Yeah, Mike referenced Martinsville. I went out there either the spring or the fall and just destroyed the car, ran into everything. I even hit a pace truck or a cleanup crew truck in the pits. trying to get around behind the wall to change the sway bar arm. We drug the sway bar arm off. Ended up crashing the car into the wall in turn 1 and 2, bent the steering wheel, car's on fire, and that was the end of the day. We was in like 4 or 5 accidents that day. Yeah.
It was all rough. Ross Chastain's fault.
Yeah, all of them were Ross Chastain's fault in hindsight. Yeah. Like, I guess walking away from that type of race, how do you, like, what was your mindset like?
So earlier in the race at Martinsville, I was a lap down, and we started on the inside. And so I was the first car lap down. They dropped a green flag, and I passed the leader, and I drove away by a straightaway from the leader. And Dad was running in the top 10, so I knew he could see all this. And so we get in the helicopter to go home, and it's me, Dad, and Michael Waltrip. And we're eating hot dogs, you know, got us a bag of hot dogs on the way home. And Dad said something like, "Man, was there, you know, you hit about everything out there today," or said something like, "You know, what was going on with you?" And I was like, "Man, you didn't see me straight away the leaders that one time. That was pretty damn impressive." And Michael Waltrip just starts laughing like hell, because Dad's trying to get me to go, "Yeah, I see all my mistakes, and I know what I should have did different." And I'm like, "Do you see my ass straight away? Them leaders or something else?"
Whooped them.
Whooped their ass for about 20 laps.
That's a good way to remember that race. You know, speaking of the Japan race, I saw someone on the YouTube chat calling in all the way from England.
Damn, all right.
What does it take to get NASCAR back international like a Japan race?
I love it, man. I think it would be awesome to I love the idea of taking our cars and going into international environments and in front of an international audience on an oval. So,
you know,
the street course, you know, momentum with Chicago, all the road courses that we've started to incorporate into our schedule, that's great, but I don't want to go. I mean, I don't give a crap about a cup race at another road course, even internationally, right? Even in the UK or out, I don't care. I don't want to see it. I want that audience that's never seen our cars race in person to see them race on an oval, right?
Yeah.
Our roots. And I want them to see that race we saw this weekend at Richmond. I want to take that overseas. That's what I'd rather happen. So, you know, there's not a lot of ovals out there, right, for NASCAR to go to. And so if we went international, I mean, I'm sure it's just easier to go to a road course and just, you know, that's the easy low-hanging fruit. But damn, I hope that's not what happens.
Do you know of any ovals that exist?
Rockingham,
so far?
I think it's in the UK. The track called Rockingham over in Europe.
Oh,
and it's kind of shaped like a Nazareth, or it's just kind of got an odd shape to it, but it's an oval, you know, and I think it might be functioning, but it was closed there for a while, so I don't know what kind of shape it's in. It's probably not the best oval configuration. I don't know that it put on an amazing race. It might, but there's not a lot of ovals. Tell us. Like, what ovals do we need to be considering that are international? You know, not, you know, Canada has several up there because of CASCAR and all the years of racing stock cars in that area. But I mean in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. Over in Europe. I think Motegi's still in Japan, still operational. I'd rather see us go to Europe.
Yeah.
And get in front of the F1 crowd and put on a proper oval event there.
Boy, that is – Rockingham is an awesome-looking configuration. It closed
cool.
in 2018, okay. According to Wikipedia.
It's like a square almost.
Right. It's almost like a square.
Kind of weird.
A rounded off
not
square.
A road course, no, basically.
It's not.
This next question comes from Rick. Without, you know, giving away too many of the embarrassing details, what's the best post-win party that you can remember having in your career?
That's a good question. You know, one of the funniest ones, honestly, was we didn't even win the race. We didn't need that party. We ran third at Sonoma, me and Letarte.
That's enough.
And we all flew back from the West Coast and met up at my house at 4, 5, 6 in the morning and drank till lunch, partying about our podium finish. Because I believe I had never finished better than 11th at Sonoma. For the longest time, 11th was my best result at that racetrack. And so when we ran in the top three, it was like a win for us. And we had Latart tells this story really good. We used to go test at the road courses. We used to test at Road Atlanta. We test, right, trying to get better at the road courses. And we'd go run terribly. We wouldn't run, better. And so that year, Latart said, hey, we're not testing road courses this year. Don't worry about it. I'm just going to go race. And I was like, okay. I hear you. We're wasting a lot of energy trying to test, and it's wearing our guys out, and we're not getting results. So let's just show up and see what happens. And we ended up running third. So I told him, I said, man, I'm pretty damn happy about this. And if y'all want to come on over to the house when you get home, I'll be there. And so, damn, they did. They, about a dozen people or so showed up, and we got after it.
How about that?
Yeah.
Where does that third place rank in terms of all your career wins in NASCAR? Oh,
right in front of the Daytona 500.
Yeah. Yeah. That's usually basically when we won, man. It was like, hey, when you get home, come on over. I'll have everything ready. I remember when Blaney won Pocono, he was through the woods. He was living real close. Mm-hmm. And I remember taking all the beer over to his house and having a good time. That was a lot of fun. Celebrating with somebody else, celebrating a win with someone else. But we always just said, hey, because everybody flying back was going to be getting back pretty late.
Right.
Pretty much from all the events. And so, but I would say, hey, man, the door's open. When you get home, don't even worry about it. Come on over. We'll be there. I'll be there till the sun comes up.
As the winning driver with all the media obligations and everything, were you always kind of like late to the party, like fashionably late to the party?
No, because I had my own plane, so I was going to probably get home because the teams, if the winning team's usually the last team out of the,
right.
But all the other teams that are on that plane have to wait for the car, for the winning team. And boy, we've been on the other side of that plenty of times, but it wasn't too big of a difference.
I'm going to throw an honorable mention. I always liked the story. I wasn't around for it, but it was either for Dale's first win at the in the Busch Series at Texas, or it might have been his first Cup win. But I liked hearing the story. I read it in a book actually about when he got home. Everybody was there at the house waiting on you.
Yeah.
That's always kind of cool.
Yeah. So
that's a cool moment. Yeah.
We won at Texas in the Xfinity Series, and I am riding with Dad from the airport. We land in Statesville, and we're driving home, and he's going to drop me off at my house. I don't know how this happened. This rarely was a scenario, me riding with Dad, but we're driving up my driveway, and my friends had hung sheets in the trees with stuff written on them. And it was pretty embarrassing, but awesome at the same time. And it's one of those things where your parents know you party, or they know you drink, or they know you cut up a little bit, but you don't do it in front of them, and they don't ever see it. They don't, you always clean up after the before they come over or whatever. And we're driving into a rager,
yeah.
Right? And I'm like, I wonder how he's going to react to this. And he just let me out and said, have fun. And it's his house. I'm renting from him and all that. So, but he wasn't too nervous.
That had to be the best feeling. Yeah. He's like, just go. Yeah, you're good.
Yep.
I love it. We've got time for one more. This comes from Jake. You talked about it at the front of the show. No April Fool's pranks this year, but what's the best prank that you can remember?
The best prank, I've told this one a few times, but a guy, I was in this relationship with this girl, and a friend of mine got a pregnancy test, a positive pregnancy test, and put it up in the bathroom. Oh man, he's got me good. And that's pretty low.
And pretty awesome at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think there's much topping that type of prank. Yeah.
I had, I had dumped a bucket of water and a bag of flour on him the night before at about 2 in the morning when he was in bed asleep and broke into his house and did that. And put about 2,000 crickets in his bedroom.
Same year?
Yeah, same night.
Same night.
Same night.
Yeah. Oh, this was a prank war of all prank wars.
Yeah,
if you
it was pretty ruthless.
So, okay, maybe you had that one coming then.
Oh, yeah.
You had it coming.
He got me good. That ended it.
Yeah,
that was the end of the game right there.
Hey, that pregnancy test was probably about 15 or 20 minutes of terror in his life. Where crickets, they're probably still making noise over there in that house.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You might have to move out on that one because you ain't going to get them all.
Yep.
Awesome. I think that's a good place to end it. This is really Gone Ash Jr.
All right, everybody. Thank y'all for tuning in. Appreciate everybody's support of Dirty Mo Media and everything we got going on here. We got a great guest this week. Tony Furr is coming on the show. He's a crew chief in the Cup Series in many different forms, from the Cup Series, Xfinity trucks and all that. But he also owned race cars that my dad drove at Metroline in the dirt days. His dad was the owner of Metroline Motor Speedway and Concord Motor Speedway, Henry Furr. And we're related, too. A long way down the line. But anyways, we got a lot to talk about. He's really, really connected to Dad, has a lot of stories that I want to hear that I've never heard. Also connected to the G family, my mother's side of the family. So Tony Furr is going to be a lot of fun to talk to, and also cheated a lot. He got busted a few times pretty bad by NASCAR on some things that he did to his cars. Can't wait to hear some of the creative things that he had. So Tony Furr, tomorrow on the Dale Jr. Download.
Hey, before we get out of here, I wanted to say, listen, we had a big announcement this week on Dirty Mo Media, yesterday on Door Bumper Clear, as a matter of fact, that they are going to have a new streaming partner, Dirt Vision.
Oh, man.
That's right, starting April 12th. So are you making those shots, by the way?
I've made one in the seven years.
Firing paper balls.
I've made one in the 7 years we've been here, Mike.
Sorry. I gotcha. All right.
I want to stop you.
Oh.
This is amazing news.
Yeah.
I am so thankful for this. So Door Bumper Clear has been picked up by streaming company Dirt Vision.
That's right.
Everybody's been asking for Door Bumper Clear to get back on the picture tube.
Yep.
And now that they're back on the picture tube, the color box, Dirt Vision is to be thanked.
That's
for this.
Right.
So 100%. Thank you, Dirt Vision. I am so excited for that partnership. I'm pumped about that.
Listen, the other thing about that is that, and this is a big one, is that if you just register at Dirt Vision, it's free. So that's to say you can access the full episodes, the visual episodes streaming for free. You just have to register with Dirt Vision, and the registration does not require you to spend any money, right? Now, there's opportunities for you to subscribe and get all the awesome access to World of Outlaws, all the things they do. We've got some great streamers in this industry that just really kind of – there's no lack of racing coverage, but Dirt Vision is one of the big ones, and I really appreciate what they do, and I think that Door Bumper Clear is perfect for them because this is going to be just a beautiful bridge between NASCAR and the dirt world. Casey, Freddie, Brett, all of them are big dirt fans, and they consume dirt. We've got some new segments that we're going to do tied to the dirt community. So that's a whole community of passionate race fans, and I'm glad that we're able to do that and bring it, and that's all by way of Dirt Vision. So I'm very grateful for that. Speaking of dirt, I also want to just say we got the Bristol Dirt Race coming up this weekend. And so we have a partnership with them that I just really want to say, if you're looking to go to a race, this is the one to go to. Like, this is the one. It's Bristol. It's Easter weekend. They've got a lot of events planned up. In fact, let me just list off a few here. Easter Celebration, for anyone who wants to attend, it's free starting at 4 p.m. on the Fan Midway stage. Amazing lineup with keynote speaker Tim Tebow. If you've ever heard Tim Tebow speak, by the way, you leave changed. He is an amazing public speaker. So that's going to be fantastic. Music by singer-songwriters Phil Wickham and Corey Asbury. So make the Bristol Race Weekend a family weekend to remember. Visit the Kids Zone, the Food City Fan Zone, and Fan Midway. Kids Cup tickets are just $10 to get your weekend package and save. Visit BristolTix.com, BristolTix.com. Also, on this note, Marcus Smith is the, CEO of SMI. They have Bristol Motor Speedway. Next week, we have our second installment of the Business of Motorsports, and that is with Marcus Smith. And boy, Dale, we've already taped it. Kelly and I did that, and it is a fantastic conversation with Marcus, as you would expect, because he's been on the show many times. But we get right to it. We ask him about the RTA and the media rights deals and say, hey, advocate for the tracks. Why do you tracks need 65% of that cut? And listen, tell us about Wilkesboro. Listen, we're all got the warm and fuzzies about Wilkesboro. What happens after the All-Star weekend? What happens after? How's it going to survive and not fall into the same fate as it did before? And so we really ask a lot of good business questions, and that's going to be next week on the download. That will be our only episode next week because we're taking off. I'll be in the Grand Canyon, but we've got that episode. It'll drop Tuesday, as a matter of fact. So, and that'll be worth it. You'll look forward to that.
All right, everybody. Appreciate everybody tuning in. Dirty Air, Ask Junior. A lot of fun today, Tuesday, April 4th. This show's in the books. Make sure you tune in tomorrow. Tony Furr, going to have a lot of great stories. Can't wait to share all of that with y'all tomorrow. We'll see you. Check out Dirty Mo Media. Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram.